This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Lena Dunham, the creator and star of the HBO series Girls.
Hi, Dad.
Hi. Hi, honey.
What's going on?
Oh, nothing. Just taking the day off to soak up some rays. Well, also, I had a small procedure. Nothing to worry
about.
Okay,
I just met with the publisher, and they want to give me a real book deal. Not a stupid, pathetic e-book deal. A real book deal.
That's Lena Dunham's character, Hannah, on the phone with her father. Hannah is a writer who got and lost two book deals. One of her ambitions is to, quote, lock eyes with the New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani. Hannah would envy and resent Lena Dunham. Dunham not only has a new collection of personal essays called Not That Kind of Girl, she got a great review from Michiko Kakutani, who described the book as smart and funny and wrote that by simply telling her own story in all its specificity and sometimes embarrassing detail, Dunham has written a book that's as acute and heartfelt as it is funny. Lena Dunham's series Girls, about a group of friends in their 20s trying to figure out what they want out of life and out of each other, begins its fourth season in January. Lena Dunham, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on our show.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I want to start with a reading from your new book. So let's start with a reading from the very, very beginning.
Great. This is a reading from the chapter entitled Introduction. I am 20 years old and I hate myself. My hair, my face, the curve of my stomach. The way my voice comes out wavering and my poems come out maudlin. The way my parents talk to me in a slightly higher register than they talk to my sister, as if I'm a government worker that snapped and, if pushed hard enough, might blow up the hostages I've got tied up in my basement. I cover up this hatred with a kind of aggressive self-acceptance. I dye my hair a fluorescent shade of yellow, cutting it into a mullet more inspired by photos of 1980s teen mothers than by any current beauty trend. I dress in neon spandex that hugs in all the wrong places. My mother and I have a massive fight when I choose to wear a banana-printed belly shirt and pink leggings to the Vatican, and religious tourists gawk and turn away. I'm living in a dormitory that was, not too long ago, an old-age home for low-income townspeople, and I don't like thinking about where they might be now. My roommate has moved to New York to explore farm-to-fork cooking and lesbianism, so I'm alone, in a ground-floor one-bedroom, a fact I relish until one night a female rugby player rips my screen door off the hinges and barges into the dorm to attack her philandering girlfriend. I've bought a VHS player and a pair of knitting needles and spend most nights on the sofa making half a scarf for a boy I like who had a manic break and dropped out. I've made two short films, both of which my father deemed interesting but beside the point, and I'm so paralyzed as a writer that I've started translating poems from languages I don't speak. Some kind of surrealist exercise meant to inspire me, but also prevent me from thinking the perverse, looping thoughts that come unbidden. I am hideous. I'm going to be living in a mental hospital by the time I'm 29. I will never amount to anything.
Thank you for reading that. That's Lena Dunham reading the reading the opening of her new book, Not That Kind of Girl. One of the opening quotes in your book is from your father. And you say,
it is.
And you say, this is your father admonishing you. And he says, how quickly you transform the energy life throws at you into the folded bows of art. Your father and your mother are artists. What exactly was he criticizing about you there?
I believe that we had had an argument, which I had very quickly recycled into something that I was using in the show, and I told him about it, and he kind of laughed. There's this very specific laugh that my father has when he recognizes his own behavior in my work, this sort of, oh, what now kind of laugh that I had just summoned from him. And then he was sort of describing, half admiringly, half with horror, the way that he didn't feel like he could do anything without it being recycled into my work. And it kind of felt like, even though he didn't mean it as a compliment, it kind of felt like the perfect encapsulation of sort of how the day-to-day translates into what I do, at least at this point in my creative life.
Do you think he was partly saying you deflect life and turn it into art, like instead of experiencing it or instead of absorbing what I just told you, you just turn it into art?
Completely. I think that my parents have always gotten frustrated, as have certain other people in my life, you know, namely my current boyfriend because no other boyfriend paid enough attention to me to care. But they have this feeling as if I'm able to sort of feign a certain kind of self-awareness by putting it into my work, but that by putting it into my work, I avoid actually having the experience. So it's this kind of vicious cycle, but it's rough because it's the only way that I know how to process feelings and move on.
Some people think that you overshare. And I'm wondering, because you do share so much, like in your memoir, and there's so much personal stuff in Girls, whether it really happened to you or not, whether it's autobiographical or not, a lot of people just assume that it is. So have you ever made anything public that was very personal through your work or through your interviews that you later regretted saying?
You know, I thought about this a lot because it's a challenging thing when you're a person who has a desire or, let's say, a compulsion to share facts about your personal life. If that's the way you process the world, is to make creative content based on your personal life, then you have to be really careful about making yourself feel too exposed. But for me, the biggest concern is my family and the people that I love. And I feel very, very conscious of making sure that my parents, my boyfriend, my friends don't feel in any way demeaned, exposed, or abused by the work that I make, especially now. There's no writing about someone anonymously. People will pick it apart. They will figure out who that person is. There's sort of no sort of protective measures you can put in place at this point in history to take care of the people you love. So you have to be careful. And so there have been a couple times where I've said things about my parents or about my boyfriend that I felt have been taken out of context or misunderstood that have opened them up to criticism. And that is the stuff that pains me. So and I also think...
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I think the term oversharing is so complicated because I do think it's really gendered. I think that when men sort of share their experiences, it's bravery. And when women share their experiences, it's some sort of, you know, it's like people are like, TMI, too much information has always been my least favorite phrase, because what exactly constitutes too much information? It seems like it has a lot to do with who is giving you the information. And I feel as though there's some sense that society trivializes female experiences. And so when you share them, they aren't given considered as vital as their male counterparts. And that's something that I've always roundly rejected.
You know, it's interesting. I think writing about yourself and kind of shaping your personal narrative gives you a certain power over your life because you're controlling the story. But nowadays, you do that, you control your story, you put it out, and the story is not finished yet because everybody's going to tweet about it. They're going to give it their interpretation. So that sense of like controlling your own narrative, in a way, it doesn't exist anymore.
That is so accurate. And there are a few things in this book that I was terrified but to put into the world because I thought of the headline and sort of people hearing third hand what existed in the essay. And it was just, it was a really scary thing. And I really had to examine with a few of these essays, is this something that I can bear to see sort of put through that game of telephone?
Can you give us an example of one of the things you were concerned about?
Yeah, I think the chapter about date rape in the book was a really, really terrifying thing for me to put into the world because as important as the topic is, and we are also having this massive moment of cultural awareness about campus assault, which is a very gratifying thing to see, and I hope it leads to incredible change. But just sort of honestly, the idea of seeing sort of, you know, the fourth hand UK Daily Mail headline, Lena Dunham tells all about rape, was it was a nightmare to me. But at the same time, I think I knew that sharing that experience was, I not only felt it was important because of what I was seeing other young women go through, I felt it was important because of what it was going to give me spiritually to not be hiding that anymore.
I thought that was a really interesting chapter, and your confusion about, is this rape or not? Like, am I complicit in this or not? Like, what has happened here? And you were hurt. I mean, I don't mean emotionally hurt, though you were that too. You were physically hurt for a while.
It was a painful experience physically and emotionally, and one I spent a long time trying to reconcile. And I've been thinking about it a lot this week because I sent an email to somebody who I had known at that time who I had not, who was who knew the guy who had whatever we're going to say perpetrated the act, who knew him, and I wanted to make it clear to this old friend what I felt had happened before he, you know, potentially, you know, bought the book at Hudson News and read about it. I hated the idea of somebody finding out that information, because at the time that it happened, it wasn't something that I was able to be honest about. I was able to share pieces, but I sort of used the lens of humor, which has always been my default mode, to try to talk around it. And I said to this old friend in an email, I said, I spent so much time scared. I spent so much time ashamed. I don't feel that way anymore. And it's not because of my job. It's not because of my boyfriend. It's not because of feminism, though all those things helped. It's because I told the story. And I still feel like myself, and I feel less alone.
You know, the way you describe it in your book, this experience happened to you. You were telling one of your girlfriends about it, and your girlfriend said, you were raped, and it hadn't even occurred to you to think of it that way before that.
Before that, I think I had just felt that something was very wrong. I had felt that something had happened, and I remember thinking, can I ever be the same? But I was not comfortable giving myself the clarity of that, because the fact is I knew that I was sort of at this party where I was at a party, drunk, waiting for attention. And somehow that felt like such a shameful starting off point that I didn't know how to reconcile what had come after. But I knew that it wasn't right. And I knew in some way that this experience had been forced on me. And when I shared it with my best friend and she used the term, you were raped, at the time I sort of laughed at her and thought, like, you know, what an ambulance chasing drama queen. And later felt this incredible gratitude for her for giving me that gift of that kind of certainty that she had. I think at a lot of times when I felt at my lowest about it, those words in some way actually lifted me up, because I felt that somebody was justifying the pain of my experience.
Did you change anything about your behavior at parties and the kind of person you would be with, or, you know, I'm not saying this in a blame the victim kind of way,
of course,
but I'm just curious, like, what your takeaway was from that experience.
I didn't really go to any more parties. I just stopped going. I stopped putting myself into, I basically didn't have a drink for the rest of college.
Seriously?
As far as I can tell. I mean, I really removed myself from that world. And I don't know if I would have told you at the time, oh, I'm doing this to keep myself safe. But obviously, in hindsight, I started dating someone who was pretty hermetic and very sweet. And I basically removed myself from the social world as I'd known it. And then I spent a lot of time, which I talk about in the book, trying to figure out sort of what my, for lack of a better word, sexual preferences were, and whether they did in any way align with this experience I'd had, whether there was any part of me that had, in quotes, wanted that. And I think it took me a long time of self-examination and being in a writer's room, hearing about other people's sort of sexual evolutions and realizing, oh, that's not something that happens to everyone, and when it does happen, they're allowed to mourn it and feel pain about it. Hearing that helped me.
You write a lot about sex in your memoir and in Girls. A lot of the storylines, revolve around sexuality. So it's interesting to read in your book that it really took you a while to actually enjoy sex.
Yeah. It was interesting. I think I spent so much time being interested in the intellectual content of sex that I forgot to worry about whether it felt good or not.
When you say the intellectual content, you mean
I think I was
the sexual
so
politics
in,
of it, or
I mean, I wish it had been as evolved as sexual politics. It was more just that I was so fascinated by the fact that sex allowed me to be in a position where I saw people behaving in these ways that they never would, sort of, you know, standing out on the quad or sitting in a diner. I couldn't believe, you know, I've always been the nosiest person in the world. I mean, my mom always tells a story of, like, you know, from the back seat of the car, she and my dad, when I was like three, would be talking about someone from work, and I'd scream, "What color is her hair? How old is she? Does she have a husband?" Like, I needed to know everything about everyone. And so somehow when sex began, I went, oh, my God, I can't believe that you get to be in a room with somebody behaving this way.
So it sounds like it was the writer in you that was having sex.
100%. And I remember thinking, almost feeling, and I talk about this in the book, like I was, you know, a private detective standing in the doorway watching two people have sex. And I described that experience later to my friend Jemima. And I was like, you know that feeling when you're having sex, but you're kind of outside your own body and you're not really in it and you're watching from the door? And she was like, no. That's the reason I've never needed to make a sex tape, is just because I'm making one in my own mind all the time.
That's hysterical. So is that one of the reasons why sex is so central to your work? Because you've always been like the observer of it?
I think so. I mean, I think probably if I had been at all points more physically engaged, I might not remember enough to write all of these chapters. But I think, and it's interesting, you know, the thing that's always hard for me to act on girls, it's very easy for me to do the sort of humiliating sex scenes. But a moment where I'm actually supposed to be enjoying sex and engaged, I find almost impossible to bear performing that because it feels so private.
Right. So was this a disappointment to you at first? Were you expecting much more than what the experience initially was?
Yes, which I think I later realized a lot of women, a lot of young people felt that way, like a real is this it quality to sex, because I think we'd been taught by movies, by, you know, romance novels we'd stolen from our babysitters, whatever, and our grandmas, whatever, we'd been taught that it was going to be some kind of totally, you know, you were going to be transported to, you know, the Hawaii of the mind when you had sex, and ultimately that is not what happened. And so I think also realizing how much sort of self-consciousness and self-hatred made their way into the act of sex, especially, you know, sex in college dorm rooms, that was an unfortunate reality to face. But I also found something so poetic about the way that people were revealed to each other and partially revealed to each other through this act. And so, you know, on Girls, I always tell people that I hope that the sex scenes, I mean, they're not just in there for, like, the audience to have a titillating break to see, you know, the side of somebody's breast. They're in there because I think it's sometimes when we get the most information about our characters. And so they are always pushing the plot forward, if not in a concrete way, in sort of a more spiritual way.
The message you get about Hannah in those scenes is almost one of compliance. Like, oh, sure, you want me to do that? I'll do that.
Well, I think a phenomenon that Hannah experienced, and Hannah experienced it because I experienced it, was the sense that if you were a girl who didn't have an ideal body, what you had to offer was your willingness to please, your openness to adventure, and your just, you know, your desire to do it all. And I think there's a very funny joke. I don't know if you know the comedian Monique.
Yeah.
But she has an amazing joke in this DVD, Queens of Comedy, where she talks about having sex as a fat girl. And she kind of goes, she says, you want to put it in my ear? Put it in my ear. Whatever you want. I'll do it. I'm a fat girl. Just do it. I'm down for anything. I'm not like those skinny girls. I can't say no. And I remember thinking Monique had distilled something so perfect with, you want to put it in my ear, just put it in my ear, about the attitude that girls, you don't have to obviously be chubby to feel this. You just have to feel an essential sense that you yourself are not enough.
Does it kind of make you sad when you see very young girls having sex, because you know that they might be facing kind of disappointment or emotional hurt?
I think about girls having sex in high school, and obviously there's, you know, there are young couples who are in love, but I just know that, like, I was so emotionally, even if you're physically ready to have sex in high school, I was so emotionally not there. I mean, I would have been playing with Barbies if I thought it was socially acceptable. So I do feel sort of a twinge when I think about girls feeling, you know, a pressure to engage that way as young people, because I think that it's, so often our bodies appear ready for things that our hearts and minds are not ready for. And I do also think that, you know, the experience of having sex in college is this sort of sad, sad hunt for validation. And obviously that is, again, not everyone's experience. There are girls who know what they need physically and emotionally and are getting it, and I applaud them, but that wasn't me and that wasn't very many of my friends.
I'm wondering how you think movies and the accessibility of internet pornography has affected sexual relations now. And one of the things I've noticed in movies for years, and because so often now, the act begins with the two people like walking into the home, and like they cannot wait. They are in such a hurry that like they're tearing off each other's clothes.
And so true.
And the guy lifts up the woman and like slams her onto the counter, and like they're going at it. And then
they're having intercourse way before it would ever make sense in anybody's actual foreplay pattern to be having sex.
Like foreplay has become almost like non-existent in a lot of movies. You know, it's just kind of the opposite about of how it used to be when there was still a lot of, you know, censorship in movies, when there are things like you couldn't show. But I'm wondering if that like tearing off the clothes kind of thing has, if you think that's kind of entered into the real world because people think that's what you're supposed to do.
I do think that, you know, that kids have been miseducated about what sex is by films. I think that films have whitewashed sex in many ways and sort of tried to hide what is messy and what is challenging about it. And I feel like there's, you know, a couple brands like, I'm so angry, I hate you so much, we need to have sex right now, which isn't particularly healthy. Or I'm so in love with you that the minute that we get in, you know, I'm going to shed my negligee and we're going to be doing it. I mean, there's just, I think that most depictions of sex are destructive. And I also think, you know, I am by no means sort of anti-pornography. And I know that there are certain feminists who have a very strong feeling against it. And I know it's a complicated, complicated issue. But I do think that the proliferation of internet porn is insane because that's how many boys are learning about sex. The fact is, in pornography, I don't know, I don't care how much they're screaming, those women are not having orgasms, at least not all of the time. And so that is female pleasure that has been designed for men to pleasure themselves to. And so it should not be a guidebook for anybody's sexual relations. And I remember experiencing, you know, in college, just the sense that somebody was doing something that they had seen someone else far more experienced and far less sensitive do. And so, you know, as much I don't want to walk around sort of uniformly slamming pornography because I think it's a much more complicated issue, but I do think that we are in an age where young kids are getting a totally unrealistic sexual education way before it's needed.
Interesting for you to say that. This is way too personal. This is like really getting to oversharing territory, but I'll ask and you could decide how much of this to overshare. Like the character of Hannah and also her boyfriend in it talk a lot during sex and tell each other things to do. I'll skip this. This is really like way too personal. Moving on.
I was like, I'm ready for where you're going, Terry.
Okay.
I'm ready to take that journey with you.
All right. Okay. So let me ask it. Are you into like being really talkative?
Well, you know,
and descriptive, you know,
not
like
really.
Narrating.
I kind of just like, I mean, no, I think there were times in my life where anything anyone suggested to me, I was open to. And that's not a secret because that's what sort of the show is about, a young woman who thinks that she will make herself more appealing to the people around her by being completely flexible. Everything from, oh, yeah, I'll go to that party that's in deepest Bushwick to, oh, yeah, I'll pretend I'm an 11-year-old prostitute. But then it builds all this rage in her. And so, which she expresses at the wrong times and in the wrong ways. And so I think that quality of sort of extreme adaptability if you notice in all their dirty talk, Adam is talking and Hannah's kind of going, okay, all right, whatever you say. She doesn't know how to do it, but she knows how to agree. And I think that that's sort of a cornerstone of this character. But what it's creating in her is this deep, deep resentment about not being heard and not being seen. And so I think the answer is no. In my own sex life, I find that whole idea of sort of, you know, someone like creating an entire narrative where you're like, you know, a teenage slave, totally unappealing and kind of distressing. But I've definitely encountered as a younger woman people who want to engage that way and didn't feel like I was in a position to go, actually, like, I'd rather just, you know, talk about books than do it, than talk about books some more.
You write in your book about how you have a lot of phobias, including germophobia and an obsession with death. Which are the phobias that really plague you the most?
My germophobia has passed. It's expired.
How did that
happen?
Really, how did it go away?
You know, I think a lot of people with OCD find that because obviously the things they're anxious about aren't truly the things they're anxious about, it's a traveling anxiety that finds its comfortable place to rest. And then it's like a virus. It's like a virus that's, you know, or that's moving from person to person and living out its life in different forms. Like that's sort of what.
Or like a cold that travels from your nose to your chest to your throat.
Exactly. Exactly. Whatever sickness metaphor we want to use, it basically it moves around. And my anxiety has always floated. It always has a focus, and then it always goes on its way. And there's a moment of relief after I've resolved one area of anxiety, and then it hops to another, you know, lily pad and sits there for a while. And so as a kid, germophobia was a really, really easy place to go. And then it kind of, you know, it departed and went to other things. And obsession with death is the really hard one because no one can talk you out of that. Everybody can say to you, you know, you're not going to get cancer or you're not going to get Ebola, but you don't have cancer, you're not going to get Ebola, but nobody can say to you, you're not going to die. So that's an easy place for it to go back to again and again and again. At this point, I would say my anxiety often tends to rest on something that's happening career-wise, you know, a phone call I have to make, an email I haven't gotten back, you know, a person I'm worried I've offended, but probably feeling a level of distress about those prospects that is outsized.
I think it was in season 3 that your character on Girls, Hannah, has a kind of comeback of OCD. And season 2? Season 3?
End of season 2.
End of season 2. Okay, yeah.
End of season 2, but then it kind of pokes around in season 3. So it's sort of, its arc exists through both those seasons.
And how come you didn't address that at the beginning, but waited till, like, season 2 to get to the OCD? Because I was surprised that, like, suddenly she's OCD.
I know. Some people had that reaction. Some people were like, what? You're shoehorning a mental illness onto this character who's already weird enough. But the fact was that I had had an obsessive compulsive sort of, I mean, well, let's use the term meltdown right before season 1 came out and right as we were beginning to shoot season 2. I had a moment where those things came back in a way that was really harsh and uncomfortable and a reminder of how bad it could get. And that was something that, you know, because at that point I had a whole writing staff who I worked with and a close relationship with Jenny and Judd, who produced the show with me, that was something that they had lived through with me, and we thought this is exciting and important to talk about. So it was sort of based on the fact that, I mean, in the show, Hannah has to write her book, and she has writer's block, a deadline coming up, a certain kind of attention she hasn't had before, and OCD, which can very often be instigated by stress, comes barreling back. And so that really just paralleled my experience with making the show and finding myself under a new kind of pressure and resorting to these old habits.
Was it helpful to write about it like that?
It was. And what was hard was to perform it because, you know, you spend so much of your life as a person with obsessive compulsive disorder, a person with any sort of, you know, mental illness, trying to camouflage your habits, trying to appear normal. And so to say to myself, I'm going to, you know, go in front of this crew of 60 Italian men and 60 old school Italian men, some younger guys too, and perform these super personal tics and quirks, like that was really scary. That was scarier to me than any sex scene. And also the feeling like once I turn this on, once I open the floodgates of letting myself, like, you know, check over my shoulders 8 times and blink my eyes, am I going to be able to stop? And it's also so letting myself sort of enter into that pattern of physical behavior in front of my crew, that was really, really kind of intense.
So you gave Hannah some of your own compulsions?
Yeah, all of them, because I didn't know how to do any others. Because OCD is so personal, like, it's funny, whenever I've met another person with, you know, and my biggest pet peeve is when people are like, I'm so OCD, I have to organize all my socks in my drawer, like, they all have to be just in little pairs. Or people will be like, I'm so OCD, I have to go to the gym every day. That's like saying I'm so bipolar, I was mad at my mom yesterday. Like, this, that's not what obsessive compulsive disorder is. Obsessive compulsive disorder doesn't follow any, like, rules of logic. I wish my OCD had been helpful enough to force me to organize my socks. And so, but when you talk to somebody who has OCD, their habits are super specific, super specific. And so I wouldn't really know how to perform anybody else's version of it. And so I kind of just had to do my own and hope it translated.
So was it helpful for you to actually perform it and therefore kind of put it under a microscope and take it outside of yourself and put it onto somebody else, your character, Hannah?
Yes, and there was also something so cathartic about doing it and then calling cut and the crew laughing. Like, I had just done, like, a funny Carol Burnett physical comedy thing. Like, there was something so comforting about that because I spent so much time thinking that, you know, alone in my bedroom thinking I looked like a hideous mentally disturbed freak, that to then have all my, like, bros at work think that it was funny, it felt really good.
Girls is soon coming back for its fourth season. It strikes me...
Yeah, we'll be back in January.
Yeah, so that's actually pretty soon. It strikes me that you've probably had to learn a lot more about plotting than you had maybe ever expected to do because, you know, once you're into, like, a fourth season, like, the plots have gotten so, you know, there's so much more character that's been developed. It's different than doing a story or even a short movie where you go from here to there. And, you know, it's just like a finite amount of story that you have to tell. And this is just like ongoing. So I'm just wondering what it's like for you to get more and more into plot as a character.
It's a great question. You know, the first
season
kind of came out...
I mean, as a writer. I said as a character. I meant as a writer.
Same difference. But the first season kind of came out as this kind of fever dream. You know, there were so many stories I'd been storing up in the time that I had been thinking, sort of... In the time since I'd graduated from college and was sort of living this reality, there were so many stories that I had been kind of hoarding. And that, combined with the influence of Jenny and Judd and the other people I was working with on the show, just the first season kind of just, you know, spat itself out. And then after that, you know, and I think there was a part of me that always thought, okay, they're going to let me make a pilot, but not anything else. Okay, they're going to let me make this first season, but not anything else. So let's just, you know, burn it down and do as much as we can because there's a good chance that I'll be working at the children's clothing store again within 6 months. And I, once it sort of became apparent that we were going to get a little time to do this thing, that's when I really had to start thinking about what it meant to sort of sustain a story over a long period of time and to develop these characters in a way that was sort of naturalistic but also had some of the sort of tropes and energy that makes television such a pleasure to watch. And so I've definitely been on a crash course. And actually the fourth season, shooting it, there was a kind of ease and joy to it, knock on wood, which I obsessively do, that that was surprising. And I actually think in hindsight it was because the plotting was coming a little more naturally and we were able to just enjoy writing these characters again, whereas in seasons 2 and 3, there were things that we knew we wanted to cover, but, you know, I was definitely getting adjusted to figuring out how to dispense information. You know, so much of it is about deciding when you're going to reveal what and who's going to reveal it to whom. And it involves, you know, like really like working on the whole thing like a puzzle in a way that I had never learned to do because my writing is so stream of consciousness and so confessional.
Have you, Lena Dunham, and your character of Hannah gotten further apart as the show has gotten deeper into the story? Because your life has really changed in a way that Hannah's hasn't. Hannah's kind of like emotionally stuck in a lot of ways, but your life sounds like you've really, you know, been transformed in a lot of ways by the experience of doing Girls.
Well, it's amazing you say that because I think so many people ask the question, is it hard for you to write about Hannah because now you work in Hollywood and go to fancy parties and your life doesn't resemble hers? And I think to myself, no, that's not hard because, firstly, I don't go to that many fancy parties. But secondly, we all understand what it's like to feel, you know, we all can transfer the awkwardness we feel at any social event to any other social event. And you're a writer, so you use your imagination and you create circumstances that don't necessarily exist. But it is hard sometimes to continue to write a character who has such such sort of limited and limiting responses to the world around her. And I really have to remember where she's coming from and have sympathy for her and recognize that, well, just in the kind of scope of television, I mean, I don't know, our one of our writers, Max Brockman, is the keeper of the timetable of the show. He could tell you exactly how many weeks, months, years have passed since in the world of the show from the first episode to the 42nd episode. I do not have that brain. But I will say that the span of time we've covered in the show is much shorter than the span of time in which I've been doing the show. So she's grown less both chronologically and emotionally than I have since we started.
Mm-hmm.
She's only had one birthday since we began.
Oh, wow. Okay. I want to play a scene from season 3 of Girls, which was shown earlier this year. And Hannah had a deal with a publishing company called Mill Street to write an ebook memoir. And she was working with an editor there who was played by John Cameron Mitchell, who really loved like transgressive writing.
He wanted her to be like a real empowered, like the new Tamma Janowitz, just like out on the streets, doing drugs, living life. And she was like, she's kind of a nerd. Like, yeah.
So anyways, that editor died. And in this scene, Hannah's at his funeral. And Hannah and a lot of other people assumed that this editor was gay, but she's just met the editor's wife. The editor is now widow. And so
Yes. Here's
Hannah trying to talk with the editor's wife, now widow, who's played by Jennifer Westfeld. And
who's the best, yeah.
And so this is like maybe the second time that they've spoken.
Hi again.
Oh, hi.
Hannah.
Right.
Not Paige. Hannah.
I know. I'm sorry.
No, don't be. I was surprised that David has such a beautiful, just stunningly.
You thought he was gay.
No.
Yes, you did.
No.
Yes, you did. It's okay.
I didn't think he was. I thought he was straight.
It's okay.
I thought he was straight. I thought he wanted to sleep with me.
Really?
I didn't think he wouldn't have slept with him.
A lot of people think it. A lot of people think he was gay.
Well, he acted gay, so.
And you know, he was. Sometimes.
Okay. I loved your working with your husband. David was wonderful.
Oh, I bet. I mean, I know. I'm working on a book with David too. I was.
I really hope you finish the book, and I really, really hope I get to read it someday.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, now that Mill Street has dropped all of David's projects, I'd have to find a new publisher. So you know, we'll
Wait,
see.
You said Mill Street's dropped all of David's projects.
Yeah. There's David's mom. She's so devastated. Have you seen Pepper? Did you meet her?
I didn't.
She's
no.
devastated.
Wait, you were just and saying that. You were saying that Mill Street's dropped all of David's projects.
Right. That's right. For now, yeah.
So my book is dead. Do you happen to know another publisher that I could maybe slip the manuscript to if I do decide that I really want to try to keep it alive, or?
Okay. If I do give you another name, will you get the out of here?
Yes.
Great. I'll be back. Honestly. Yes.
I loved your husband.
Just a reminder, that's a scene at a funeral.
She's such a jerk.
Your character of Hannah, everything she said is so completely inappropriate.
She's such a jerk. I think she put some kind of premium on like honesty, like the idea that she's going to be the person who really cuts through it and is really real about what's actually going on. But she forgets that like certain social constructs are in place for a reason. Like that's the reason that you don't ask people for professional contacts at funerals.
So you just called her such a jerk. How do you feel about writing and playing a character who you just described as such a jerk?
It's so fun. I honestly, it's really, really fun. I mean, it's such a pleasure to play somebody who sort of lacks the filter that we all walk through the world with. And of course, like, of course I wouldn't recommend her as like, you know, a model of behavior to any young people in the world today. But I love the opportunity to just like say the word. I mean, it's funny. Tourette's and OCD are very closely linked together. A lot of people who have one have the other. And I remember, you know, I don't have Tourette's syndrome, but I definitely have the part of myself that was always afraid. One of my fears as a kid was that I was going to walk down the street and, like, just, you know, scream out a curse word or, you know, yell a homophobic slur or just do something that was totally, you know, not my personal. I was going to say the worst thing that I didn't want to say, but it was just going to come out of me. And it's almost like that Tourette's-y, horrific part of me gets to be expressed in Hannah, who's just firing off, and she just can't stop. I mean, she just can't stop.
Now, Hannah's friends are pretty self-absorbed, too. And one of the characters, Jessa, who's played by Jemima Kirk, is so destructive. She's self-destructive, but she also does damaging things to everybody she knows. She seems to have, like, no empathy or sympathy. And she's hurtful. Like, I wouldn't want her to get near me. I would never let her in my house. I'd be afraid
she's
that she'd,
not
like,
a nice
steal
girl.
Something or you know, like, you know, read something that, you know, it was very personal that I had.
She would definitely read something personal.
She would definitely do that. And I wonder, like, why would anybody even be friends with her? So tell me why that character exists and why Hannah and or any of the other girls in the series is friends with her.
Well, I think Jessa is a character who has a real glamour to her, a real free-spirited glamour. I mean, you would be amazed by how many girls tweet at me like, I want to be Jessa. I want to be a Jessa.
That shocks me.
Because she has this sense of, like, she just kind of, like, blew in on a cloud from Morocco, and she's doing her thing. And I think what we really wanted to reveal was the pathology behind sort of the concept of the free spirit, sort of this like, iconic ideal of a free-spirited woman is ultimately hiding a very wounded, dissociated person. And so I don't think Jess is evil. I don't think she's a sociopath. I don't think she, you know, I think she wants to do good, but more powerful than her desire to do good is her desire to test the boundaries and, like, sort of her sort of unfillable hole of pain. And I think that the girls like having her in their life because they find her glamorous and they like what it feels like and looks like to take her to a party or post her on their Instagram. And I think they think she's real in some way and that she tells them what's really going on. And also there's that sort of that inertia that comes with being friends with someone in your early 20s, early to mid, sometimes to late 20s, where it's very hard to remove someone destructive from your life just out of sheer force of habit and fear of change.
Was there someone like that in your life?
There's been a few people like that in my life. And, you know, I really have tried. I don't think I used to know the difference between someone being eccentric and someone being, you know, a destructive nightmare. I think I thought that the two went hand in hand. And now my life is full of people who are special and unusual and strange, but don't scare me or hurt me or put me in dangerous situations. But I don't think I used to be able to make that distinction. So I had a few friends who have sort of been Jessas. And, you know, Jemima has some of that glamour, but she's deeply kind and responsible, and she's a mother of two. But there were some people who I was really transfixed by and sort of followed around for a period of time who ultimately didn't have my best interests at heart or their best interests or anyone's.
Oh, that's interesting. Thanks for telling us about that.
Thank you. I liked the concept. I think at a point I really liked the concept of that kind of lost girl, mm-hmm. that girl who was sort of moving through the world. Like, you know, she had a little bit of a Zelda Fitzgerald lost broken woman romance quality that is not as charming to me as it used to be.
Right. Lena Dunham, it's really just been so great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
It's so nice to talk to you. I always love being here, and it's always very surreal to hear you say the words fresh air. Thank you so much.
Lena Dunham's new collection of personal essays is called Not That Kind of Girl. Her HBO series Girls returns in January. We have a Lena Dunham extra for you, a short section of the interview that we didn't have time for in the broadcast, in which Lena Dunham talks about her definition of feminism. You can hear that on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/freshair. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.